Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the November edition of Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a visually and print-impaired audience. Our first article is called Condoleezza Rice Gets Personal. An extraordinary, ordinary people, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice chronicles her childhood in the segregated South and the devoted family that helped her make her a star on the global stage. She gave Ladies' Home Journal a sneak peek. Why write two memoirs? I didn't think I could do justice to the story of my family and my life as a policymaker in one book. Her second memoir comes out next year. This book is about growing up in America during extraordinary times with parents who had incredible values about life and education. I didn't want that story to be shortchanged. Next question. Are your parents the extraordinary, ordinary people? It's my whole extended family, really, but my parents in particular. I remember them saying, "You might not be able to have a hamburger at Woolworths, but you could be president someday." That was pretty remarkable outlook to have during segregation. Next question. What's the best advice your parents gave you? I'm very glad my mother didn't let me quit piano lessons at age 10. She said I wasn't old enough or good enough to make that decision, and she was right. I did not like that my mother said those things to me, but later on when I got a chance to play with Yo-Yo Ma and more recently Aretha Franklin, I thought, I'm glad she said what she said. Would you consider that you've lived a fulfilled life if you never get married or have kids? Her answer, yeah, I will. I won't have kids, but I still could get married, but I would have a life. I would have lived a fulfilled life if I'd gotten married and had kids too. I'm very religious, and at some deep level, I believe that things work out as they're supposed to. The key is to be open and to appreciate the life you've been given. Is managing a sports team still something you dream of doing? Her answer, it's the only thing that would get me to leave Stanford. Rice is a professor of political science at the university, but have always taken life one step at a time. When my students come to me and they've got their 10-year plan, I always say, just figure out the next thing you're going to be doing. Enjoy that, do it well, and see where it leads. The last question, you say you won't run for office. Any chance you'll change your mind? Her answer, I don't see myself as having that fire. But you never know. Like I said, it's about figuring out the next thing and seeing where it leads. The next interview was with Taylor Swift. The four-time Grammy winner talks about her new album, Turning the Big 2-1, and her favorite crush-worthy guy. The first question, why I called my album Speak Now. My songs are like open letters. They say everything I wished I had said when certain people were standing right in front of me. I imagine I'll be getting a few text messages from these people once the album comes out. How I write songs? I have an app on my iPhone that's a voice recorder. I'll be in the middle of a conversation, and I'll literally walk away to record a bridge, a pre-chorus, or half of a hook, then go back to the conversation like nothing happened. Person I'd most like to collaborate with? Jay-Z. Our genres are completely different, but there could be something cool about that. My must-have makeup? CoverGirl has these Outlast lip stains that I like. I'm always throwing my hair around on stage, and if I wear sticky lip gloss, my hair gets stuck in it, which is a total mess. How I'll celebrate my 21st birthday on December 13th? Maybe I'll have a glass of wine, but nothing too hardcore. I need to be in control of what I say, and if I drank, I'd stress out about saying the wrong things. on my life list, seeing my album in Starbucks. I go there every day, and I just stare longingly at the CDs they sell. What I look for in a guy? Someone who loves you for who you are. I like doing cute art projects with glitter, and there have been guys who made me feel that was weird. But then there are guys who find it endearing. A favorite Thanksgiving tradition? Eating the marshmallows and the candied yams. My Hollywood crush? Taylor Lautner. It's always going to be Taylor. After spending 20 years trying to tame the kinks in my hair, I finally stopped messing with Mother Nature and learned to love my look. The name of this article is called Curl Power by Meredith Moran. When did I start hating my curls? Not when I was 3 years old or 7 or 10. In photos at those ages, I'm looking out from a mass of kinky black hair and smiling. But that at that fateful age of 13, my best friend and fellow curly girl, Zoe, and I started studying teen magazines with a passion our schoolwork never inspired. Zoe and I were desperately seeking clues as to what we were supposed to look like, which is to say, who we were supposed to be. Our unscientific investigation yielded a list of beauty musts. Be a size 2. Complexion, flawless. Clothes, hot off the runway chic. Ethnicity, none. Hair, straight. Zoe and I got the message. We were 0 for 5. And what could we do to raise our scores? Not a heck of a lot. We were already dieting, of course. As I mentioned, we were American teenage girls with teenage complexions and teenage wardrobe budgets and tight-knit Jewish families. There wasn't much we could do about our skin or our clothes or our ethnicity. But straight hair, that was a project to which we could devote our considerable energies, and that's exactly what we did. The more we researched, the clearer our cultural curlophobia became. In every makeover story, the girls in the before pictures had hair like ours, but in the after shots, they had straight hair of the celebrities we worship. Zoe and I, both fans of high drama and ritual, pricked our pinkies, mingled blood, and took a solemn vow we'd never let ourselves go out of the house looking like one of those before shots. I can still feel the orange juice cans I wrap my hair around at night before attempting to sleep, and the hairbrush headaches I gave myself in the morning while beating my Brillo top into submission. I became an amateur meteorologist with my head as a barometer. I'd stick it out the window first thing every morning to assess the strength of my enemy, humidity. The more moisture in the air, the more hairspray I used. There were days when if you touched my hair, it would crunch. In eighth grade, when the stakes got higher, boys, I ramped up my efforts. My family lived in New York City, and every 6 weeks I rode the bus uptown to the conch parlors of Harlem. Conching is hardcore, lie-based method of straightening kinky hair, and it was my secret weapon until the morning I woke up to find a clump of hair on my pillow. With lie no longer on the menu, I turned to more labor-intensive but less risky methods, like ironing, bonnet hair dryers, and huge rollers. For the rest of my young adulthood, my life revolved around keeping my straight hair persona in place and that naturally curly-haired woman incognito. I'd love to say that a sudden burst of self-acceptance broke this habit, but in my case, it was something far less enlightened. Desperation. By that time, I had 2 kids and a full-time job, and I was willing to try almost anything that would give me a little more time in my packed schedule. So one Saturday morning, I left the kids with my husband and sought the advice of someone who really knew her curls. Betty was the first black woman to cut my hair, but apparently I wasn't her first kinky client to hide behind a straight-haired screen. When I begged for a way to simplify my styling routine, Betty layered my hair, then subdued it, and with a handful of magic potion, ironically called Curl Activator, suddenly my unmanageable frizz was replaced with well-mannered ringlets. Betty's Wash, Curl, Activate, and Ghost style added 2 hours to my day. For the first time since age 13, I was wearing my own hair, or at least a reasonable facsimile thereof. I was in curly hair heaven, and I stayed there, I mean exactly there, for another decade. Fast forward this year when I flew in from California to visit Zoe in New York. We arranged to meet at our favorite Manhattan sushi joint, but I barely recognized my childhood best friend with her stick straight hair. "Japanese thermal straightening treatment," she greeted me. "It cost a fortune, but it's worth every cent. People take me more seriously with straight hair. I've gotten whistles, dates, even jobs I would not have gotten with that mop on my head." I stared at her, feeling betrayed, and I thought about a recent makeover story I had seen. Flipping on the before and after shots, I felt that time had stood still. Just like in the magazine of my youth, several of the before shots featured sad-looking curly heads. The afters, straight-haired beauties. In so many ways, we come a long way. Since Zoe and I were self-bashing teens, on the hair front, though, not so much. In comedian Chris Rock's 2009 documentary Good Hair, which explores why so many African-American women want to straighten their hair, Rock offers some kinky black hair to a wig shop owner. "Everyone wants straight hair," the Asian owner explains, refusing the offer. "It looks more natural." We live in a world where the WASP stereotype has a tremendous hold on our imaginations, says author Lorraine Massey in her curly hair how-to book, Curly Girl. Even straight hair starred Super Angelina Jolie reported complained after she went shopping for a doll to resemble her Ethiopian daughter Zara. "I look for a Barbie that's African, and the African Barbie had straight hair." As we ordered our miso soup, Zoe announced with the kind of bluntness only a lifelong friend could get away with, "If you must wear your hair curly, at least get a new style. You outgrew that look 10 years ago. There are all kinds of new curl products out there. Go find yourself some." A few days later, I sat in the waiting area of a posh San Francisco salon that specializes in curly hair. The hair cutters and clients alike were a collage of diversity, black, white, Asian, Latino, old and young in between. And the place actually smelled nice. No fumes from chemical straighteners stung my nostrils, and I didn't smell that hair was being blowed fried into compliance. The salon owner, Marie, led me to her chair, smiled into the mirror, and asked, "What would you like to do today with your beautiful curls?" For years, I've been playing it safe, believing that the only thing that tethered my hair to gravity was its weight. I answered that question by saying, "Just a trim, please," again and again and again. My long hair had been my signature through 5 presidents, 2 marriages, 3 careers, and more changes of heart and mind than I could count. Maybe it was time for my hair to catch up with my ever-evolving self. 90 minutes later, Marie handed me a mirror and then spun my chair around. "So how do you like your new short hair?" I stared at my reflection, completely stunned. Could those perfectly formed, bouncy, utterly unfrizzy curls be mine? I left the salon under a shower of compliments and floated to my car, peering at myself in shop windows, feeling lightheaded, literally, and thinking that change might affect more than just my hair. My lifelong war with my curls has kept me at odds with myself, engaged in a futile struggle to be, or at least look like someone else. Now I realize that the road to self-acceptance isn't always a straight line. But the long and the short of it is, getting there is well worth the twists, turns, and curls along the way. 12 Ways to Think Yourself Thinner by Rachel Grumman. The first way, number 1, ban the word diet from your vocabulary. "Diets are temporary," says Lona Sandon, RD, an assistant professor of clinical nutrition at the University of Texas. "The word implies you'll go off it at some point rather than developing healthy habits you can maintain throughout your life. Plus, diet is such a motivational killer, thanks to its many negative connotations, hunger and deprivation, just to name 2. Focus on the positive aspects of eating healthy, such as feeling more energetic." Number two, don't make it all about dress size. Yes, wanting to fit into your skinny jeans can inspire you to slim down, but you're more likely to succeed if you think beyond the superficial. Meaningful goals like setting a good example for your kids or avoiding a health problem that runs in your family are more motivating and will make it easier for you to resist temptation. Write your goals down and refer to them often to reinforce your determination. Number three, be realistic. Forget everything the weight loss infomercials tell you. Dropping a dress size in a matter of days is pure fantasy. Trying to lose too much too quickly will frustrate you, and you will be more likely to give up on your weight loss plan when it doesn't happen. Aiming to shed a pound a week is more realistic. Better yet, don't just focus on the scale. Create easily attainable mini goals, like using skim milk in your coffee instead of half and half. Meeting them will help you feel successful and excited to make more healthy changes. Number four, think twice before you drink. It's easy to convince yourself that liquid calories don't count, partly because you consume them so quickly. When it takes little to no effort to swallow something, people will almost always say it has fewer calories than it does. Another reason that beverages don't seem filling? Gulping down a drink doesn't provide the same satisfying sensory experience that chewing food does. Don't be fooled. Give soda, sugary coffee concoctions, and other high-calorie drinks the same occasional treat status you assign to foods like cake and brownies. Number five, don't swear off your favorite foods. Making treats totally off limits could sabotage your weight loss goals. Dieting women who were deprived of chocolate for a week had more intense cravings than those without any food restrictions, and they consumed twice as much chocolate as they usually did when they were finally permitted to eat it. The smarter strategy is to allow yourself a small portion of treats you love. That way you won't feel deprived or obsess about what you can't have. Number six, expect imperfection. Okay, so maybe those small indulgences turned into a big splurge. Instead of feeling guilty, which may prompt you to eat more, let it go and tell yourself to make a better choice at your next meal. Ironically, expecting the occasional setback could strengthen your power of resistance. A study published in Psychological Science found that people who are the most confident in their self-control may be more likely to give in to temptation. Number seven, visualize your success. Picture your slimmer self walking on a beach in a bathing suit, playing with your kids without getting out of breath, and wowing friends and family with your new shape. Images like these provide the enthusiasm you need to keep eating well and exercising. Number eight, mind your table manners. Do you find yourself racing through meals even when you're not short on time? Wolfing down your food isn't just rude. It could prevent you from reaching your weight loss goals. That's because eating too quickly may interfere with the release of gut hormones that help you feel full, which could lead to overeating, according to the research published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology. Train yourself to eat more slowly by putting down your utensils between each bite. You shouldn't be loading up your fork if you haven't finished chewing the previous bite. Taking the time to savor the taste, texture, and aroma of your meal may help you feel satisfied with less food. Be a picky eater. Don't waste precious calories on the foods you really don't love. Before you raid your coworker's candy drawer, for example, stop and ask yourself, is this a special must-have indulgence, or could I eat it any time? Would I rather spend my calories on something else? You may realize that candy isn't a must-have at all. Number 10, don't indulge a craving the minute it strikes. It will probably go away in 15 to 20 minutes. We're serious. Distract yourself while you wait out a yearning for cookies by drinking a glass of water, playing a game on the computer, or taking a walk, or simply picture anything other than cookies. In a recent study conducted at Finders University in Australia, volunteers who had been experiencing food cravings reported that those cravings eased after they were asked to think about non-food images. Number 11, avoid peer pressure. You've probably heard that women are more likely to overindulge when they eat with other women. To avoid social dining sabotage on girls' night out, check the restaurant's menu on its website and make a healthy meal choice ahead of time. Picture yourself saying your order and asking the waiter for water with lemon instead of soda. Placing your order first helps too. Once you've asked for the grilled chicken salad with dressing on the side, you won't be easily swayed by a pal who orders mac and cheese. The last tip, number 12, ditch the put-downs. Negative beliefs like, I have no willpower, or I will always be this heavily, can become self-fulfilling. Needless to say, they won't do much for you in the motivation department either. The good news is that positive self-labels can also influence reality. People who describe themselves as being healthy eaters report consuming more fruits and vegetables and fewer unhealthy foods, according to a study at the University of Ottawa. Think it, be it, there's no easier weight loss strategy than that. Now it's time for the answer lady. This month, our wise and witty expert takes on wedding gift rules, a Thanksgiving dilemma, and a coworker who's a little too friendly. First question. I paid a lot of travel expenses to go to my niece's out-of-town wedding and couldn't afford a gift at the time. Is it too late to buy her a present? Here's the answer. It's never too late for gifts, really, although most gifts guests give in advance or on the big day, it's an accepted rule that you can send a wedding present for up to a year. And surely your niece and her new husband will appreciate your thoughtfulness. If they've registered at a store or online vendor, their registry is likely to remain open for 2 years. Getting that missing eighth piece place setting or the rest of the wine glasses will make your belated gift a very welcome one. To combat any potential embarrassment, include a note. I didn't forget, hope you still need this, and that the first few months of your marriage has been as lovely as your wedding. Next question. One of my colleagues is a huge flirt. It's harmless. We're both happily married. But how can I tell him to stop without making it awkward? Here's the answer. Just be gentle and good-humored about it. Dave, can you dial back that love a bit? I know you don't mean anything, but people are getting the wrong idea. If he argues, be a little more blunt. Seriously, I feel uncomfortable with some of the things you say. This kind of banter is often a two-way street, so make sure you're not sending mixed messages. Don't say, even if you are the best-looking guy in the building, you can't sit on my desk. Do say, Dave, please sit in the chair. He may be a little wounded at first, but if you've set a good example, he'll catch on. The last question. My sister is bringing her family of five for Thanksgiving. My daughter invited her roommate, and my husband asked three coworkers. I'm overwhelmed. Can I say no? I wouldn't, especially if the roommate and colleagues are already invited. You could try being candid with your sister, though. Confide to her that with the other surprise guests, this may not be the year to come. The true spirit of Turkey Day would suggest, however, that you put out the welcome mat and plan to feed 9 more people than usual. If you normally have a formal dinner, don't worry about everything being perfect. Embrace the joys of prepared foods and disposable silverware. Ask your visitors to bring side dishes or desserts and let them help in the kitchen. Who knows? You might start a new tradition. The Cleanup Crusader by Nancy Gottsman. 8 years ago, Anna Cummings attended a lecture about marine pollution. She was shocked to learn about the sea of plastic trash floating between Hawaii and California, dubbed the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. "I was an environmentalist, but even I didn't realize how bad it was," said Cummings. It's estimated that 80% of marine trash starts on land. Plastics are especially toxic since they act as a sponge for chemicals like motor oil and DDT. "I began to think about what I could do to help," Cummings says. She realized she could make a small dent in ocean pollution by starting close to the source, the people in her own Santa Monica neighborhood. Cummings wanted them to embrace reusable bags and cups, but instead of trying to change individual habits, she got local stores involved. She went to a Merchants Association meeting and pitched her Bring Your Own idea. "It's a small change that adds up to a big difference," she says. "Every time you reuse a bag or cup, it's one less piece of plastic that could end up in the sea." A representative from Patagonia, who was at the meeting, loved Cummings' campaign. The company awarded her a grant and donated 200 reusable bags that were printed with her Bring Your Own logo and established at schools and farmers market. Cummings even created an eco-themed website, bringyourown.org, where she writes about plastic pollution and has sold more than 500 reusable produce bags. That life-changing lecture by the founder of Algalita Marine Research Foundation also motivated Cummings to volunteer for the organization. In 2008, she helped build the Junk Raft, a boat made of 15,000 discarded plastic bottles that sailed from Los Angeles to Hawaii. The following year, she biked 2,600 miles down the West Coast and met with universities, mayors, and corporations along the way to spread her message to end plastic pollution. "Preventing this problem will take a long time, but I'll never give up," says Cummings. "I know we can make an impact." So here's Lady Holmes Journal's challenge. Clean up a beach, waterfront, or town park. Organize a group cleanup day throughout your local government or chamber of commerce. Or check out the Surfrider Foundation, a nonprofit that supports water quality regulations and water testing activities. They're at surfrider.org. To reduce waste in the first place, bring your own reusable sacks, water bottles, and coffee mugs. Keep a stash in your car so you won't forget. Attention Cyber Monday shoppers. Sure, you could be brave and battle the pre-dawn Black Friday crowds, but if you'd rather not turn holiday shopping into a full contact sport, score great deals on Cyber Monday, November 29th instead. Instead, online shopping expert Michelle Madhawk gives us her four-step strategy for getting the best bargains. Number one, simplify your search. Bookmark sites that compile deals in one places, such as freeshipping.org or shefinds.com. Two, get an edge on other shoppers. Stores often share sales and coupon codes with subscribers first, so follow them on Twitter or like them on Facebook. Sign up for their online newsletters. Three, make a plan. Send retailer newsletters to one email account, then create a list of what you want to buy. Before Monday, match the items on your list with the offers in your box. You'll save time and money. Number four, this is important, study up on return policies. It's easy to overlook them once you start shopping. Read each site's policy ahead of time so you don't end up with an item you can't return or exchange. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long, until next time.